contact with Indian regiments whilst you're doing this?
Yes, a lot of the demonstrations were given by Indian regiments. And also there were about Indian non-commissioned officers, senior non-commissioned officers, where people like Sumter and Hamildas and people like that. And one or two of the training sessions were given by these people. We had a very pleasant Gurkha officer who was captain, and he spoke beautiful English, and was greatly admired by one and all.
And he was a Gurkha?
He was a Gurkha. He was a Gurkha, not just a Gurkha, a British officer in Gurkha, but he was a Gurkha, yeah. He'd been in Burma as well and come out.
What was the general opinion of the British soldiers towards the
Indian Army? They were very highly thought of. Some were not as well known as others. The Dogras weren't terribly well known, and one or two of our chaps who, or rather my year, my intake, who were posted to the Dogras, weren't too happy about it, but they had to go anyway. The Sikhs were very popular. Of course, the Gurkhas. Yes, I think on the whole, we had a respect for, despite the fact that at that time the Indian National Army, with Chandra Bose, you know, he had been recruiting a lot of ex-Indian soldiers into that army. Despite that, they were respected. They were respected.
Were there any problems in your own area at that time with the civilian population?
It was independent
politicians.
There was always sort of riots going on, yes. Nothing terribly serious. We were never called out for anything. But they were always going on, and you were advised to be careful when you were down in the bazaar, you know, keep your wits about you. Didn't drink much around those days, actually. So, you know, one was usually fairly sober and was aware of what was going on.
Were they comfortable barracks?
Yes.
Typical
just barracks again, yes. I think I shared a room with another bloke. I can visualise him now, but I can't remember his name. Jimmy somebody. He's a Scotsman. Yes, we had a bed each and a mosquito net over it, and a locker for our kit. We didn't have any civilian clothes. It was all out of uniform. Had all lightweight KD, hockey drill.
And woken by your maid servant?
Yes, he brought you a cup of tea in the morning, and we weren't encouraged to. Soldiers used to get themselves shaved by these blokes. But we were encouraged not to allow that and do it ourselves. The food was basically Indian stuff. It was Indian curry at lunchtime. Breakfast would just be maybe a couple of slices of bread with some jam or toast with some jam and marmalade on it and coffee. And then the midday meal was curry, of which I could never get enough, actually, because I used to love the curry. I still do. And it was part of my life at school. Very important. And then we used to have dinner in the evening, which was always an English meal, or usually an English meal. Three-course soup, main dish, and sweets.
How long did the course last?
I think it was 6 months.
It's quite a long one.
That's quite long, yes. It was not as long, it wasn't as long as the British one. I think they were a bit longer. Not sure now. It was just after the armistice in the Far East, which was August the 15th, which I joined my battalion. So, and that was it. That was 2 July, and they had just come out of Burma. So, and I went over to India in early 45. Yes, it would be about 6 months. Yes.
And you were a regular soldier. Were the other intake regulars?
No, I wasn't a regular soldier then. I was a wartime commissioned officer, but I was commissioned.
And the others, were they similar?
Same. Yeah. One or two of them were thinking about joining, staying on as regulars. But to do that, you had to go before the regular commissioners board. I did eventually in Singapore.
And you said you joined the 2DLA?
I joined 2DLA, yeah. We were given, when we passed out, finished at the Octu, we were given 2 weeks leave and a warrant to go from wherever we went, which was for holidays. A lot of people went up to Kashmir. And myself and three others went down to Bombay. And it was it was quite a good record, actually, because you were allowed to claim then a fare plus three times the fare. No, a fare plus three times the fare as a movement, as a travel allowance. So it was, you know, it was quite... It took about a day and a half to get from Maradon to Bombay. And we stayed in a big hotel, not Taj Mahal, but a big hotel behind it for a fortnight. And then I got the train up to a place called Uruli, where the battalion was stationed, and there somebody came and picked me up and took me to the battalion headquarters, where I met the CO, and I can't for the life of me remember who the CO was at that time. I remember quite a number of the officers that were there when I first joined, and I became friends with them after. One or two of them were from this part of the world. A lot of the wartime commission officers were from here.
Young officer, what was your first pay?
My first pay? It was about 30 shillings a week or something. It wasn't much. Very, very, very little. I know, you just about had enough to pay your mess bill if you were careful with what you drank. That was even in India, and I presume, that one got some form of overseas allowance across your road over there. But it wasn't much at all. But I wouldn't swear to that. My recollection is it was about 13 shillings a day. That's it. 13 shillings a day, yes. That's it.
And did you have to pay the Indian service? Did you have to pay them?
Who?
Your own Indian service.
Oh, well, the batman. Oh, yes, you had to. Give them something. Yeah, I think I used to give them a quid a week or something like that. I mean, whatever the going rate was, we were told. So junior subalterns pay so much and so on. You paid a little bit more than I rank you were. Yes.
And the battalion had come out of Burma.
They had been out of Burma for about a month, I think. And of course, quite a number of the soldiers who had been in Burma were still there. They hadn't been repatriated. There'd been a big changeover, of course, but there were still Burma veterans there, you know. The greater part of them were new recruits or new people that had just joined.
How did they receive you?
Very good. Who were the soldiers, you mean? Generally, yeah, they were great, yes. The chap who brought me, he brought me from the station. He had been in Burma with them, and he said, well, where have you spent the war, sir? I said, mostly in Nepal and Noctus. He said, yeah, no. I said, no, I just missed it. But he was very polite and very pleasant. I never saw him again. I think he was repatriated the next day, or he said he was going home anyway. I wasn't unique in that respect. Most of the people, including the officers, actually, they had just joined, especially the junior officers. And a great number of the soldiers as well. A lot of them had been gunners during the war, and they had been rebadged to join the infantry to go out to the Far East to fight the Japs, because the Jap war was still on when the European war finished.
Did you know the history of the battalion in India? What it had done, what it had been up to when you joined it?
Oh, yes. I knew the history of it, yeah. Yes, I've been in Kohima and that sort of thing, yeah. Oh, yes. Yep.
So there's quite some tales to tell, or did they speak much of it?
There weren't many tales, no, because not many people that were left who had actually been there. There weren't many people that had left who had actually been in Kohima, which was their major thing. One or two of the senior company commanders had been on the march down from Kohima to Schwebu, I think, which is where they eventually finished up, and they were taken out and set brought to Uruli. I didn't ask, actually. I didn't ask very much in the way of tales from the people who had been there. Later on, we got quite a number of people back, people like Sean Kelly and Tommy Buick, Frankie Hiles, you know, people that had been actually in Burma and Kohima. Then I got I found out, you know, more about what went on. Yes.
Was it a good mix, this experienced battle
no,
group?
No, not really, no. That was one of the problems, really, because there was a complete new battalion, virtually. And all the ones that had been in Burma, most of them anyway, had been shipped home. And one of the several of others was being on the way, you know, by the time I got there. So it was a bit of a hotchpotch set up. We got a number of Australian officers who had been in the Pacific with their units, Australian units, and had transferred to us. Why, I don't know. And we had about six of them altogether. And I quite liked them, actually. My company commander was an Australian chap called Tinkham, who was as mad as hell. But I quite liked them. And there were about five of them that I really did like. I thought they were good company and well worth knowing. Unfortunately, I haven't really kept in touch with them. John Arnott, when he took over as regimental secretary, he made an effort to get in touch with them, but I think quite a number of them had died, and you know, he never did. He got two addresses, which I wrote to, but I never got a reply. And it was a matter, really, of trying to mould them all together. I had a platoon at that time, obviously.
I should ask you, what platoon did you join? Where did they place you in the
battalion? I was platoon commander in A Company. The company commander was Chap Tinker. And shortly after I joined, actually, we were moved out to Malaya.
The new men coming in, were these national servicemen?
They weren't national servicemen, no, they were wartime soldiers, yeah.
The World War Times.
Yes. No, National Service didn't come in until about 1948 or something, wasn't it? Yeah. They were wartime chaps. They all had a DMOB number, and they were waiting for DMOB.
Presumably these had come into the battalion later in the war, though.
Yes.
The older ones, the long-term ones, would be shipped back home.
That's right. The ones that had been in Burma with the battalion had been taken away, and the ones we got, as I say, were reinforcements either from the depot or from the gunner regiments, which caused a lot of strife later on, which I'm talking about, but that was how it was constituted. So you really had to sort of start from scratch with a lot of them, because they'd been gunners, you know. Admittedly, they'd been soldiers and they knew the basic drills and all that sort of thing, but they hadn't been light infantrymen, so you had to do, we did a lot of drill practice.
They must have resented this.
Oh, they did. I know. We had near mutinies on our hands later on in India. Yeah.
Well, how long were you in this place in India before you moved to India?
Only about a month. The brigade, in fact, had begun moving before I got there. They were moving to Malaya, and we were the last unit in the brigade to go. And it just so happened that a delivery of an issue for the whole brigade of beer was delivered about a week before we were due to go. so we drank as much as we could of it, and then what was left we put into crates with a few jungle green trousers or jackets on top, and put wanted on voyage. And all through the voyage we used to go down, get this stuff up, and then when we finished it, throw the bottles through the porto. So I imagine that there was a trail of beer bottles all the way to Malaya, to Singapore, from Bombay. But because in those days, of course, the boats were dry. You weren't allowed to, there was no button alcohol in the bar or anything like that, so we had to take it home. And that's how we did it. Nobody ever bothered us, actually. We used to just go down to the hole every day to collect as much food as we could, bring it up, and the whole, everybody would be, that's officers, of course, you know, would be tucking into this stuff. It was a ship called Subaja. It was a Dutch ship, Subajax, S-U-B-A-J-A-X, pronounced Subaja.
That's a boat that actually took the 151 Brigade back from Sicily to England.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, well, we were in the tradition. Yeah. It was very comfortable. The food was excellent. I remember they always had record periods during the day, you know, what's it called, pick a tune or something. And it always started with a song called Don't Fence Me In. I got the words. I don't remember many words of song, but at one time I used to be able to sing the whole thing right through, you know. And every day, about three times a day, when they would have this program on, you got this tune. Again, we did, you know, on the way over, it took a week, I think, to get to Singapore. We got 10 days. We did the usual sort of keeping our hands in with rifles and that sort of thing. Had a boxing match, in the battalion. And a couple of the officers took part, actually, not me, but a chap called Cuthbertson, I remember him. He just used to live down here. And he was a good boxer. Yes. So that was done. We eventually arrived in Malaya, I think probably around about the end of August, beginning of September.
Were your weapons and so on still of the older type?
Yes, very much so. Hadn't reached India yet. They eventually came, you know, in about 1950. Yes, no, we were still training with the really old stuff. The old blunt nose 303, you know.
And you were part of the 6th Brigade, 2nd Division?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Two different.
Were they members that were arriving in Malaya?
Well, absolute chaos. It was the gloomiest day that I can remember in my life. It was very overcast. The thing about Singapore is that it's sticky. And it seemed to rain every afternoon. We arrived about midday, and it was just before the daily rains were due to start. And it was black, like it was like night almost. And I remember going ashore and meeting various people who were themselves on their way down to Java, because the Japanese hadn't really surrendered down there, and the Gurkhas and various other units were going down to sort them out. And they were yellow. And I was with Mepkin. We just started Mepkin, taking Mepkin. But these poor chaps look as though they were all suffering from jaundice. You know? And there seemed to be a sort of an air of disorganized haste. And we all seemed to be dashing all over the place. And everybody seemed to be doing that. And I didn't find Singapore at all impressive. We were put in a train and taken up to Johor Bahru, which was just on the other side of the causeway, and we settled into a place called Majidi Barracks, just outside Johor Bahru. They were very comfortable, actually. They were purpose-built barrack blocks, one of the few that existed out in that part of the world. And we were sleeping on charpoys with mosquito nets, and we had little houses. The officers messed with quite a nice, comfortable building. And we had a Chinese cook who used to produce really nice meals.
Wasn't the same number of native helpers there as had been in India?
Yeah.
Let me write down to the men's level as well.
Yes. And we also had a batman, of course. You know. Yes.
Why were you there? Why did they send you to Malaya?
Well, I think we were originally part of a thing called Operation Zipper. It was called that because it wasn't buttoned up, I'm told. I mean, it was further up, just before we got there. We landed in Singapore, but a lot of routes were landed up in Port Dickson. And this was, well, they did it as an invasion, you know, and it was either Force 136 or their own information was all a bit bad, but they were caught on a sandbank about 500 or 600 yards off the beach, and they all sort of trooped off and disappeared underwater. You know? And apparently the Japanese local general was standing on the beach shaking his head, saying, "We lost the water this night, you know." He's waiting to surrender. So that's why it was called Zipper. But our bit of it was all right, because we came to the docks and came ashore. There was no opposition of any sort, and they weren't even there waiting to surrender. And we went up, as I say, to Majidi Barracks, did we? No, we didn't. We went to the Chinese Girls High School. That's it. First, we went there. That's right. We went to, and that was very uncomfortable because it was just a school, and we had to sort of make do with whatever there was around about with other buildings. We had quite a reasonable officer's mess. But there was a very severe shortage of taps. I think there was only about 8 or 9 taps in the whole place, and everybody had to wash and do everything else with these taps. The washing of clothes, and that's all done by the Dhobi, but our own sort of personal hygiene was all done under these taps. And the result was that we got a terrible outbreak of skin disease. There was ringworm, scabies, and of course Dhobi itch. And the ringworm was really severe. And the way we were curing it was by putting neat iodine on the rings. And it used to burn them out, you know. But very, very unpleasant and upsetting. I got Dhobi itch. This lad is from the way the things were washed. And in fact, I think most people in the battalion have Dhobi itch. And the thing about Dhobi itch is that it separates and it becomes very itchy between the crutch. And the more you scratch, the more you want to scratch. And people will be standing around scratching away, and then a little relief, and then it would have to start again. And we had 3 WRAC officers in the mess as well, and they had it. And they used to have to go out, stop scratching, and come back in again. And it was really dreadful. And while we were there, actually, it was Anzac Day. We sent some buglers down to Singapore to blow for the Anzac Day celebrations. And on the way back, one of the 1500 weights slid off the road for some reason or other and fell into the canal. And there were 2 Australian officers were killed, and three beaglers were drowned, actually, which was a bad ending to that day.
You mentioned malaria, and you're taking
medicine. Yeah, I had to take medicine. Yeah.
And to ensure that.
You used to have to get them all on parade first thing in the morning. There were 2 things I had to take. I had to take a salt tablet and a meprican tablet. And they used to come with their cups of tea. And you would give them the pill. They would stick the pill in their mouth, have a drink of water, and then say their number. And then they'd do the same with whichever other pill was left, and they'd say the number. And then it was assumed then that they'd taken the 2 pills. But they still managed to get away with it. You could always tell when a bloke hadn't taken his salt tablet, for instance, because invariably he would faint during the day because it was so sticky and the sweltering that he sweated a lot, and the loss of salt and all that. That's why he took them, you know, to keep the salt content up. They would just pass out, and they put them on a charge then because they were not taking the medication. And of course, the medical used to make you turn yellow everywhere. You know, your eyes were yellow, your skin was yellow. Yes, we had to do a lot of that.
Did there have been unpleasant effects of taking?
Just the taste. The medical particularly tasted horrible.
Once
you
were down, they were okay, except you turned yellow.
Yes. Oh, sorry.
Once you were down, they were okay, except that you did turn yellow.
There were no other. Not that I recall. Apart from the filthy taste. And I played this occasion on Christmas Day where the officers play the sergeants. They brought on some refreshments, which looked like lemonade, and it was, in fact, a whole stack of American tablets. So dissolved in water, we would take huge gulps of water. What a terrible taste. So that they were the two main events of the day, the gunfire with the two tablets. And then, of course, it was just carry-on training, as the usual individual skills and platoon skills, section skills, platoon skills, company skills, from just round about. We did a lot of ceremonial stuff, I suppose. We were in fact, on parade when the Japanese surrendered officially on the part of Padang in front of the Government House in Singapore. I've got a photograph of it somewhere like that. Mark Batten took the Japanese general's sword. I can't remember the name of the general. But Mark Batten, we were the guard of honour.
You didn't get into rounding up the Japanese at all, did you?
Well, not really, no. They didn't need rounding up, they were coming in from in the lair anyway. There was a little bit of rounding up necessary up in Burma, but they were coming in, and we were using them as menials. There would be an officer and maybe about 30 blokes, and they would come in, they would clean the camp out and do all the dirty work. And wherever you went, if you passed one of them, they would stop whatever they were doing and bow. You know, you wouldn't think that they'd been unpleasant while they were fighting the war. They're complete surrender. In fact, I was sent up later on, I think when we moved up to Majiji Barracks, I was made mortar officer, and I was sent up to on a course to a place called Twine, where I did the course, and then when I finished the course, they sent me, the mortar platoon, up there, and I took the place over. And I had a platoon of Japs with an officer as my sort of minions, you know. And I remember on occasions, one of the soldiers, Jap soldiers, had done something, I don't know what it was, and he asked me if I could borrow my Japanese sword so he could behead the bloke. I said, hey, you can't do this. You'd have to find some other way to chastise him. I don't know what he did. That didn't interfere. But I mean, they were quite happy living like pigs in the proverbial, you know, and no complaints. No complaints. That was it.
Yeah, there mustn't have been a great deal of affection towards them, knowing what they did.
None at all.
Come back again to the initial arrival in Malay and the immediate period thereafter. What were the Malays like? How did they receive it?
Well, the Malays themselves were very unobtrusive because they mostly lived out in the kampongs. But the Chinese, who were the next, actually, there were more Chinese there than there were Malays, really. And of course, Singapore was almost entirely Chinese. They were very friendly. They used to like Chinese. And we were often out invited out to Chinese meals and dinners and that sort of thing. Well, later on, when we got up to up country, when we got to know more Malays, because they were more Malay than they were Chinese, we became friendly with the Sultan of Negri Sembilan, and he used to invite the officers over for a what's called a ronging, which was a dance that would be preceded by a really good meal. I mean, this was at the time when rice was in short supply, you'd have the plates piled high, about six or seven of them on a table of, 15, or about a 15 or 20 yard table, and all the dishes were carried, and you would sit there until you could leave, and you couldn't eat anymore, and yet the kampongs were starving. Yes, we became very friendly with Negri Sembilan, actually. One often came across the Malays while one was patrolling. There was a little bit of